Our reading is from John's Gospel, chapter 12, and you'll find it on page 1084. When Jesus had said these things, he departed and hid himself from them. Though he had done so many signs before them, they still did not believe in him. So that the word spoken by the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled: "Lord, who has believed what he heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed?" Therefore they could not believe. For again Isaiah said, "He has blinded their eyes and hardened their heart, lest they see with their eyes and understand with their heart and turn, and I would heal them." Isaiah said these things because he saw his glory and spoke of him. Nevertheless, many, even of the authorities, believed in him, but for fear of the Pharisees, they did not confess it, so that they would not be put out of the synagogue. For they loved the glory that comes from men, for man, more than the glory that comes from God. And Jesus cried out and said, "Whoever believes in me believes not in me, but in him who sent me. And whoever sees me sees him who sent me. I have come into the world as light, so that whoever believes in me may not remain in darkness. If anyone hears my words and does not keep them, I do not judge him, for I did not come to judge the world, but to save the world. The one who rejects me and does not receive my words has a judge. The word that I have spoken will judge him on the last day. For I have not spoken on my own authority, but the Father who sent me has himself given me a commandment, what to say and what to speak. And I know that his commandment is eternal life. What I say, therefore, I say as the Father has told me."
Thanks very much, Jeremy. Thanks, Marcus. Do keep Bibles open. And we'll be those white sheets will be a help as well, if you've got one of those in front of you. David Cameron recently declared that he believes Britain is a Christian nation. It wasn't the first time he said it, but he said it again just before Easter, and it sparked a bit of a debate in the papers. And there's been a lot of discussion, if you've been following it, about the numbers of people who define themselves as Christian. According to the 2011 census, there are now 59% who define themselves as Christian in this country, which is down from 72% a decade ago. And there's people on both sides of this debate about whether Britain should be known as a Christian country, who are understandably trying to find polling results to support their position. But I wonder whether this fascination with the numbers behind it is the assumption, not simply that the biggest group, the majority group, defines the character of the nation, which I'm sure has some truth in it, but also is there the assumption that the biggest group or the majority define which position is true? After all, you know, we reason to ourselves, how can so many people, especially so many significant people, which must be part of the point in that distinguished list of signatories who objected to David Cameron's results in that Telegraph letter, how can so many people be wrong? And I think I find myself buying into this sort of reasoning myself. I was on the wharf earlier this week. This kind of principle that, you know, more people must mean it's more true. So I was talking to a guy from Canary Wharf Management. We're talking about possible venues. He asked me how many people came to the barge, and I quoted our highest figures rather than our average figures, just to bump it up, just to give it a bit more credibility. But actually, is popularity a good gauge of the truth of something? So if we're here today as seekers, you know, we're those who are trying to find authentic spirituality, if we want to find real answers about life and about truth, is it possible that popularity isn't a good gauge necessarily of truth, and that actually the road less travelled might in fact be the right one. Well, the passage we're looking at, and this is, hopefully you've got it open in front of you, 1084, is this passage is at the hinge of the whole Gospel of John. Most people divide John's Gospel into chapters 1 to 12, where Jesus reveals himself through signs or miracles, and then the second half, chapters 13 to the end, where Jesus reveals himself through the cross and resurrection. So today's verses, you'll see, are the climax of part 1. And what we discover is that just at this moment, as Jesus' public ministry draws to a close, so this incredible ministry, it's included the most incredible miracles, the most profound teaching, the most perfect life that this world has ever seen. So after 3 years of God himself walking this earth, publicly revealing himself, the impact Jesus has had is pathetic. His public ministry is an utter failure. So look now at verse 37. This is a summary. Though he, Jesus, had done so many signs, that is miracles, before them, they still did not believe in him. And if you were here this time last week on Easter Sunday, we looked at that verse at the end of John's Gospel. Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, but these are written so that you may believe. And if you're here, we looked at the whole point of these signs and miracles is to convince people. But here at chapter 12, we see at this stage at least, they simply haven't done the job. They haven't worked. No one seems to be convinced. Now as readers, if we're reading through the whole gospel, this hasn't come as a total shock. In fact, John began the whole of his gospel with these words in chapter 1, verse 10. He, Jesus, was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. And those verses in chapter 1 and these verses in chapter 12 are a kind of bookend that show that this is one section and also that this is one of the main themes of the first half of the books. But we're still asking the question, why? Why is Jesus' ministry so unpopular? And actually, doesn't that discredit him? Doesn't that invalidate his claims a bit? And what these verses we're going to look at now show us is that actually there are deeper reasons behind the rejection of Jesus. And these reasons reflect very badly, not on him, but on us as human beings. So let's look at point one there. The rejection of Jesus was planned, so don't be thrown. And I'm going to read again from the beginning, from verse 37. Though he had done so many signs before them, they still did not believe in him. Why? Verse 38. So that the words spoken by the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. Now some people say that one of the things that really makes God laugh is human beings making plans. I guess we all know that we love making plans, but the reality is they often change a lot in the outworking of them. But God's plans are different from ours. They always happen exactly like he plans. And the rejection of Jesus, we're learning here, was planned and predicted by God hundreds of years in advance. Now, John could have just told us that the rejection of Jesus was planned and predicted and left it at that. But he takes us now to a very significant passage, Isaiah 53. It's a famous passage from 700 years before Jesus, which predicts that the promised one, God's servant, will be deliberately unimpressive. We actually sung the words of it in that hymn we just sang. And I'm going to read now this verse that John quotes in Isaiah 53, and I'm going to keep reading the couple of verses which continue on from it. So Isaiah 53, who has believed what he has heard from us, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? So this is the prophet Isaiah, he's predicting that lots of people won't believe in God's servant. We ask the question, why? Well, Isaiah continues, for he had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. And as we thought about when we were looking at the passage in John, immediately before the one we're looking at tonight, if you were here a month ago, throughout his life, Jesus consistently revealed God's glory in all that he said and did. But we thought then, didn't we, that it was a strange kind of glory. It wasn't a showy, presidential candidate, glitzy kind of glory. It was an ordinary, hidden kind of glory. It reminds me a bit of that article, I don't know if you saw a few years ago, that when the world-class violinist Joshua Bell, he was in Washington, and he'd just, I think three nights before, filled Boston Symphony Hall, where the cheapest tickets were going for $100 a pop. But 3 days later, he took his $3.5 million Stradivarius violin, he put on his baseball cap and his jeans, and he busked the same concert outside a Washington metro station. And in that hour, out of 100 people passing by, mainly top brass government executives, only 7 stopped to listen. And Bell raised the princely sum, so he left out his violin case and people threw in change occasionally. He raised the princely sum of $32. Now, the point is that Joshua Bell's performance was glittering. It was glorious. But it wasn't glitzy or showy. So for those with eyes to see it, Jesus' divine glory shone out again and again. But for most people, he didn't fit with what they were looking for in a Messiah. They wanted him to improve life now, bread in their stomachs, political regime change, or whatever it was. But his concern was on preparing people for eternity, suffering and dying to pay for the sins of the world. Their focus was on outward respectability. But Jesus kept on challenging people to turn, not just from immorality, but also from self-righteous religion. And just again and again, Jesus didn't seem to play the game properly. He didn't seem to fit with the values of the people around him. You see, Jesus was deliberately unimpressive, in part to divide people. So just as with Joshua Bell, the proud people who were only interested in showy and glitzy performances, they walked straight past. But for those who were prepared to tune in and to listen, they got more than they ever dreamed of. Now, this is significant for us in this whole question we're looking at of how to find authentic spirituality. If one of the great things in London, you can find whatever you want to find. But in London, there's all kinds of places, not least churches, which are outwardly very impressive. The presentation is slick, the worship experience is very powerful, the message is encouraging. But sometimes, if you listen closely, the Jesus who's offered, the Jesus who's preached, is very different from this Jesus, the Jesus of the Bible. The real Jesus, who consistently humbles the proud and he constantly challenges the me-centeredness and the now-centeredness of our world. So let's make sure, if we're looking for truth, that we're not constantly looking for a different Jesus, a Jesus who we find more palatable or more impressive in different ways. Because, of course, if that's what we're after, we will end up missing out on the real Jesus entirely. But there's a further reason in these verses why so many people reject Jesus. Not only is he deliberately unimpressive, but, I've put there on the sheets, God deliberately hides himself from those people who are unimpressed with Jesus. Let me read from verse 39. Therefore, because they were unimpressed and didn't believe in Jesus, they could not believe. They could not believe. For again, Isaiah said, verse 40, he has blinded their eyes and hardened their heart, lest they see with their eyes and understand with their heart and turn, and I would heal them. And now, if you've been at the Barge for the last few weeks, Mark has preached this passage in Isaiah 6 4 weeks ago. And if you're here, you'll remember how he was explaining that God hardens those people who refuse to believe, so that in the end, they can't believe. God's judgments so often are to give people what they want. So if we don't want to believe, eventually we won't be able to believe. And again, understanding this principle is very helpful for us if we're seeking greater spiritual clarity and certainty. So if we're going through doubts, you know, if God seems distant from us, if it feels like there's some kind of spiritual blockage for us at the moment, then rather than standing with our arms folded, you know, wondering why God won't come when we whistle or when we click, you know, like our Labrador does, it's worth stopping and asking the question, is there something which God has said to me which I'm ignoring? Is there something that is on my conscience at the moment which I'm covering up? Because while ever we're refusing to respond to what God has already revealed to us, we're in danger of his voice getting fainter and fainter until, of course, we won't be able to believe in this verse. And this is helpful for us to understand if we're looking into the faith as well. So, of course, if that's us, we need to look at the evidence. That's why Jesus did these signs and why they're recorded here, so that we can look at them, investigate them. But there is a point at which we've been given all the evidence we need. And at that stage, we just need to respond to what has been revealed to us. We just need to stop and break the ice with God, to pray to him, to commit to him. Or we'll find we get hardened to him. And there's a third reason in this passage why people reject Jesus. And that is because, I've put there on the sheets, our love is misdirected. So let's look at verse 42. Nevertheless, many even of the authorities believed in him. But for fear of the Pharisees, they did not confess it, so that they would not be put out of the synagogue. So this is an interesting group of people. They were convinced about Jesus at one level, but they knew that if they followed him, they were going to get expelled from the synagogue, which is a kind of social death in those days. They'd be excluded from the community. That would be the end of all their prospects, all their children's prospects. They'd all be dead socially, effectively. And so the cost for them of following Jesus was just too high. And John wants us to see here that what is behind their reluctance to stand with Jesus, to be known as his, is a misdirected love. So why didn't they publicly confess Jesus? Look at verse 43. For they love the glory that comes from man more than the glory that comes from God. Or as Jesus puts it back in chapter 5, verse 44, how can you believe when you receive glory from one another and do not seek the glory that comes from the only God? Do you see, whatever we care more about what other people are thinking of us than what God thinks of us, Jesus says we cannot have a real faith if that's us. There's a story I like about the late John Stott. John Stott was the rector of a big church in here in London, and he was at one stage Time magazine 100 most influential people in the world, quite a big character in the Christian world. And one time he was trying to let his flat out to some tenants, and someone had been put in touch with him. He was a young Christian man. He wanted to rent the flat. And John Stott rang this guy up and he said, thank you for your interest. I've read your references. They all seem very good. And the reply came back, oh, I am glad. That's good news. And then there was a pause on the line, and Stott replied with quoting Jesus' words, woe to you when all men speak well of you. And it was just this kind of awkward moment. He was obviously winding him up, and the poor lad had no idea what to say. But it was just Jesus' words are very significant there. You know, a good reputation is a good thing. You know, we are to want a good reputation and to, you know, try and keep it. But the point of Jesus' words, if others' opinion of us matters more than God's opinion, then of course we will never be able to follow the one who was despised and rejected. That's the point here. I guess we've all seen the effects of peer pressure at various stages. When we were at school, do you remember the kids at the back of the class and they were more interested in showing off to their mates than in doing what the teacher wanted? Or we've perhaps seen it in a professional context where folk are more interested in boosting their image in the team than following the team leader's strategy. In all these situations, this tendency is actually destructive. But when this dynamic happens on a spiritual level, the point is it is toxic. It is spiritual poison. So John has been giving us in this passage three explanations of why it is that people don't believe in Jesus. He's given us human pride, human sight being blinded, and human self-love. And whilst it's good for us, I think, to look at these reasons, to reflect on how they might be obstacles to our own faith in various ways, I think that the main reason we're being told this about why people reject Jesus, as I've put here in point one in bold, is so that we're not thrown by other people's unbelief. So that we're able to see that people rejecting Jesus back then and people rejecting Jesus today does not reflect badly on Jesus, but reflects very badly on us as human beings. So popularity does not determine the truth of something. Thankfully, Jesus' lordship is not being put up for a public vote. It's secure, however much people are going to ignore it or reject it. And this is important for us to understand so that we don't lose confidence in speaking about Jesus. You know, there really is nothing lacking in Jesus' revelation. He is light. He is exactly what every person on this planet needs. But having given some explanations here for why he was rejected, Jesus now goes on to explain the seriousness of rejecting him. And that's point two. It actually says point one, but the second point one on the sheets. The rejection of Jesus is serious, so don't be caught out. And the reason rejecting Jesus is so serious is because Jesus reveals and represents God the Father. I've got those the wrong way around. So if I'm going to say first, he represents the Father, verse 44. And Jesus cried out and said, "Whoever believes in me believes not in me, but in him who sent me." Now, traditionally in this country, I don't know if you knew this, a town crier, when they came to bring a message from the king or the queen, the response to the town crier was deemed to be your response to the king. So if you obey the town crier, you obey the king. If you kill the town crier, it's as though you've killed the king. You'd be sent down for treason. And Jesus is saying here that whatever we might say about our relationship to God, a person's relationship to Jesus Christ is actually our relationship or our response to God himself. But Jesus isn't just an ambassador. He's not just like a town crier. Jesus actually perfectly reveals God. So verse 45, "And whoever sees me sees him who sent me." Jesus is saying, if you look at me, you are looking at God. Verse 46, "I have come into the world as light, so that whoever believes in me may not remain in darkness." So the reason why our response to Jesus is so important, so critical, and why rejection of him is so serious is because Jesus perfectly reveals and perfectly represents God to us. And actually, and this is the next point here, it's our response to Jesus' words in particular, which is so critical. So throughout verses 47 to 50, if you look at them, there's a tremendous emphasis on Jesus' words. Let me read just the first of those, first two verses, verse 47. "If anyone hears my words," Jesus says, "and does not keep them, I do not judge him, for I did not come to judge the world, but to save the world. The one who rejects me and does not receive my words has a judge. The word that I have spoken will judge him on the last day." So do you see, it's our response to Jesus' word, which we have in the Bible, which is so important. Now, positively, that is good news. It gives us a way forward. As we're thinking about on Easter Sunday, obviously you and I didn't get to see Jesus' miracles, but actually that doesn't mean we're disadvantaged, because all we need to do is just respond to his word, to trust it, to obey it. But negatively, it means that what I can't do is I can't say I accept Jesus, but then ignore his words. Loyalty to Jesus in the Bible always means loyalty to his words, not picking and choosing the bits of the Bible that we like or that we find palatable. Now, if you look at 47 and 48 again, there's what looks like a contradiction. It seems in 47 as though Jesus doesn't judge us. Say 47, "If anyone hears my words and does not keep them, I do not judge him." But then 48 suggests that he does judge us. 48, "The one who rejects me and does not receive my words has a judge. The word that I have spoken will judge him on the last day." So how does it work? How can we reconcile this? Does Jesus judge us or doesn't he? And the answer from these verses is that Jesus came into this world to save it, not to judge it, not to condemn it. But of course, if we're those who reject his message, if we reject the one offer of eternal life, our rejection of that message is what condemns us. It's like saying, you know, why did that person drown? And we can say, well, they drowned because they swam away from the life belt. In that sense, the life belt kind of condemns them. You know, what we do with Jesus' offer of eternal life, what we do with the life belt, will be what justifies or condemns us on the last day. I think whether we are here tonight as those who believe in God or not, or whether we believe in a judgment day or not, all of us tend in various ways to divide the world, don't we, into those who are in and those who are out, those who are acceptable or unacceptable. We tend to have a standard, perhaps a level of behaviour which we think is okay, acceptable. And you have to be, well, for some people, sufficiently liberal and progressive, or for other people, you have to be sufficiently traditional and moral, whatever your perspective is. But anyone who then doesn't meet that grade, that level, we define as unacceptable. But actually, if you think about it, judging people on that sort of basis is pretty crude. And in some ways, it seems a bit unfair. You know, if I'd grown up as a child soldier in northern Sudan, the chances are my life would look quite different and I would have made some pretty different decisions in my life. But you see, God cuts through all of that. And he says, what is going to really divide people on the last day is one question. The only thing which really matters is this: what did you do with my son? How did you respond to Jesus? Did you receive him? Did you love him? Did you trust him? Did you follow him? Now, some of us will immediately be thinking, what about those people who haven't heard? And of course, they'll be judged on the basis of the light that they have received from creation, from conscience. It's a bit like if each of us had a little microphone taped to us and it recorded every time we thought or said ought or should when we're talking to someone else. You should do that, you ought to do that. And that all of those shoulds and oughts are going to be recorded and come back and actually judge us. And it'll be shown that we didn't even live up to our own shoulds and oughts, let alone the standards of God from Scripture. But the point is that everyone in this room has heard of Jesus. So that's not our category. And God asks each one of us, what did you do with my son? And that is a very personal question for God. Jesus told a story about a vineyard owner who let out his vineyard to tenants. It's a picture of God and humanity. But the tenants failed to produce any fruit or to pay their rent. And so the owner sent messenger after messenger, the prophets. Some messengers they beat and sent away empty-handed. Some messengers they even killed. And then finally, the vineyard owner gave them one last chance. And in the parable, he says this: I will send my son, my only son. Surely they will respect my son. So God asks us, what did you do with my son? Now, as a society, we've made ignoring Jesus Christ into a very small thing. We've lined him up on the shelf alongside all kinds of other, you know, religious and philosophical options in case anyone happens to be interested and want to take him down and have a look. But you see, that is not the way God sees it. For God, ignoring Jesus could not be more serious or more personal. What did you do with my son? And the people Jesus has in his sights in this closing speech are not just those folk who are outright rejecting or outright ignoring Jesus. He also has in his sights those folk, like the ones we looked at in verse 42, who say, yes, I believe, but then practically speaking, it doesn't seem to make any difference. In fact, they're not even prepared to be known as believers. And that's why Jesus talks about those who hear my words and do not keep them. Do you see that in verse 47? The point is, keeping Jesus' words is not, you know, have I once at some stage in my life prayed a prayer of commitment when I was young? Keeping Jesus' words is persisting in listening to, trusting, obeying Jesus day by day. In 1999, Jonathan Aitken famously crashed, didn't he, from cabinet minister to convict, and he did it very rapidly. And if you've been in a growth group this last term, you'll remember that interview that we watched with Vaughan Roberts. And he said this: previous to prison, I was what you might call a half-Christian. which I now know is about as much use as being half pregnant. It was a phony relationship with God rather than a real one. And then if you watch the interview, he goes on to explain how this ordeal of his, through it, Aitken woke up, spiritually speaking, and he came to realize that the most important thing in life is trusting and obeying Jesus Christ. Nothing matters more. And the reason why this is so important is because, as we've seen, one day each one of us here is going to stand before our Creator and be asked the question, what did you do with my son? Now we're going to have a moment's quiet to reflect on these verses, to think what the Lord is saying to us individually. Then in a moment, musicians are going to play and we'll stand and sing together.